Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Today on our program, we're going to hear from experts on another bailout plan for Greece and negotiations continuing on an Iran nuclear agreement. Our social media reporter speaks with us about possible Russian use of trolling.
To either create the impression of more Putin support than there is, or to sort of muddy the waters with inflammatory accusations and conspiracy theories.
And there have been a couple of important developments in the U.S. presidential race. It's all ahead here on The Voice America. After a marathon 17-hour session, members of the 19-nation Eurozone today managed to negotiate a third bailout to keep Greece in the common currency bloc. VOA's Victor Beatty joins me, and he's been following the story. Victor, what do we have on this?
Hello, Susan. Well, European Council President Donald Tusk met with reporters this morning in Brussels after an all-night session.
Today we had only one objective, to reach an agreement. After 17 hours of negotiations, we have finally reached it. Someone can say that we have an agreement. Leaders have agreed in principle that they are ready to start negotiations on an ESM program, which in other words means continued support for Greece. There are strict conditions to be met. The approval of several national parliaments, including the Greek parliament, is now needed for negotiations on an ESM program to formally begin. Nevertheless, the decision gives Greece a chance to get back on the track, with the support of European partners. It also avoids the social, economic and political consequences that a negative outcome would have brought. I welcome the progress and the constructive position of Greece that helps to bring back trust among Eurozone partners.
Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras agreed to tough reforms in return for a three-year bailout worth about $96 billion. Greek banks have been closed for nearly 2 weeks and are nearly out of funds after the previous bailout expired June 30th. Leaving the country little choice than leave the Eurozone and start printing its own currency. It was just a week ago, July 5th, when Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected previous bailout terms by the country's international lenders. Well, the new bailout plan reportedly imposes harsh conditions on Athens on labor reform, pensions, taxes, and privatization. The plan must be approved by the Greek parliament by Wednesday night before bailout talks begin. Shane Oliver, chief economist of the Sydney-based AMP Capital, told me the plan could be politically costly for the Tsipras government.
It's very uncertain as to the future of Tsipras in Greece. I kind of think that he's hoping to hang in there and maybe edge a bit more towards the centre-left rather than the extreme-left from which he's come from. But we could see emerging in Greece a more centrist party combined with elements of Syriza, the current governing party, with some of the more moderate leftist parties going forward. So it's certainly unclear as to how that politics will unfold, but I think at the end of the day, sort of the leftward lurch that the election of the Syriza government brought in, its days there are probably numbered.
Shane, did the Greek government essentially agree to what the voters rejected in last week's referendum?
It is very perverse, and what you've seen in Greece is that the policy or proposal that was passed through a few days ago, passed through the Greek Parliament, was actually as tough, if not tougher, than what had been rejected by Greek voters in the referendum. So it almost seemed perverse in a way. I think what has happened there effectively is that the referendum, the shutting of the banks, has sort of shown to the Greek government how bad things are getting, and therefore they've literally become desperate to get something done. So they are moving down a path which, if ultimately accepted by Greece, will end up with more austerity, tougher conditions than was originally on offer.
That's Shane Oliver, an economist in Sydney. Greek debt stands at a staggering $357 billion, about 180% of the country's annual gross domestic product. Greece has received nearly $270 billion in two previous bailouts in exchange for austerity measures that include deep spending cuts, reforms, and tax hikes, and for now at least, avoids being the first country to exit the Eurozone since its founding in 1999.
Thank you, Victor, for details.
All right, Susan.
News of the Greek bailout deal is being heard by the buyers and sellers in world stock markets. My colleague Alexis Christophorus in New York is following the story and joins us on the line. Welcome, Alexis.
Hi, Susan. Hi. Good to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Nice to have you. Say, is it good news or bad news for investors today?
Well, this is a knee-jerk reaction to that deal with Greece, and we're seeing that U.S. stocks are following European and Asian stocks sharply higher. As we know, the Eurozone leaders reached an agreement for a third bailout program for Greece, avoiding a Greek exit from the Eurozone, at least for now. This is still far from being a done deal. National parliaments must still approve this deal before formal negotiations can begin, and analysts warn that's when the real work will begin. They caution that Greece is far from being out of the woods just yet. The Greek banks and stock market remain closed with strict limits on how much money can be withdrawn from ATM machines. Meantime, limited access to money means many Greeks are not paying their bills on time, and that includes the big ones like their mortgage and utility bills. And when banks do finally open, analysts say that the banks must do so in an orderly way, or they will see Greeks lining up to withdraw all of their money from the bank. Susan?
What a big mess. Hey, tourism is really important in Greece. Is this going to be affected?
Tourism is a huge industry. In fact, industry number one for the country of Greece. And believe it or not, Greece is looking to its tourists to help pay off its debt. As part of these new punishing austerity programs, Greece is expected to impose harsh new tax hikes on businesses. And guess what? Those are expected to get passed along to tourists on popular island destinations. So if you're traveling to Greece, most probably in the next few weeks and months, you can expect higher taxes for food at restaurants, hotels, water, and the theater. Susan?
I'd love to go to Greece, but not anytime soon.
I know, and hopefully not many people feel that way, or else Greece is going to get hit in a whole other way. You know, despite all of the troubles Greece has been going through, tourism has really held on and been quite strong. They saw a nice rebound even this past year. So these higher taxes could mean that people will choose other destinations for their vacations.
Well, thanks, Alexis, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Critics of the latest austerity measures imposed on Greece have gained a lot of attention on Twitter for rallying around one particular hashtag. Michael Lippin is here with me and has been following that story for us. Michael, which hashtag is it?
Hey, Susan. Well, you know, the hashtag you're talking about is "This is a coup." That's all one word. In this context, the word coup refers to the idea that those imposing the austerity conditions on Greece are in fact trying to overthrow the Greek government somehow. So many people have been tweeting hashtag "This is a coup" that the Topsy Analytics website shows it's been used 374,000 times in the last day. One Italian Twitter user was so upset that he took his anger out on Germany, which has led demands in Europe for Greece to take painful steps. User Stefano Vicciani wrote, "Can we live without German products? Yes, we can. Hashtag boycott Germany." Now, a big supporter of the Greek bailout deal, European Council President Donald Tusk coined a new expression when he made the announcement earlier Monday at a news conference. Tusk called it an agreement. Obviously, that's a play on the word agreement. It soon became a Twitter hashtag in its own right, but even that phrase has been co-opted by people tweeting about how bad they think the deal is. Susan?
Thanks, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Technological advances have allowed genetic scientists to conduct research in a matter of hours that at one time may have taken days or months. Genetic researchers are making significant progress in tracking down causes of major diseases and conditions, which will lead to improved diagnosis and treatments. Unfortunately, since many researchers don't have ready access to the kind of computing systems that can process tremendous amounts of data, important advancements in genetic research can be hindered. Scientists from the University of Missouri have introduced a free online service that could help provide the kind of data processing needed by these researchers. Called RNA Miner, the new computing service could help scientists obtain faster results in plant and animal genomic research. A typical data analysis request may be finished in several hours by RNA Miner, and the service is free. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A dizzying string of meetings are underway in Vienna to try to bring to a close the Iran nuclear deal. And my colleague, Jeffrey Young, is following this story. Matter of fact, he's going to have a special report about it if they do reach a deal. And Jeffrey is right here in the studio with me right now. Jeff, what you found out?
Hi, Susan. Ali Reza Nadera, senior analyst at RAND Corporation, and I went over the agreement as we know it stands right now. He points out how both sides can come out as winners in this deal. We also talked about whether this agreement might trigger a Middle East arms race, as some claim that it will.
If the final nuclear agreement is based on the framework agreement that was released in April, then it could be a very solid agreement. For the first time in 12 years, Iran and the P5 plus one, the UN Security Council plus Germany, will have come to an agreement in terms of what Iran will be able to do regarding its nuclear program. Potentially, this agreement will prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapons capability, but also allow Iran to pursue peaceful nuclear activities. And overall, this could be good for global security and regional stability in the Middle East. It could really release or decrease tensions between the United States and Iran that have built over the last 10 years.
There are reports, and you've seen them too, that some people claim this agreement may trigger a huge arms race in the Middle East because Sunni nations may want to arm themselves. What's your reaction to that sort of mindset?
If we're talking about nuclear arms, this is unlikely, as the cost of producing or creating a nuclear weapons program are very high in terms of the economic, political, and geopolitical costs. For example, if a country X wanted to emulate Iran, then it would be deterred by the cost Iran has borne because of sanctions and isolation. And a lot of the countries in the Middle East are allied with the United States, and essentially they would either have to jeopardize their alliance or go ahead and produce nuclear weapons. In terms of conventional arms, there's already an arms race in the Middle East regardless. So the nuclear agreement in itself isn't likely to lead to nuclear proliferation. It could increase tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the short term, however.
There has been much discussion about the amount of higher enriched uranium. I didn't say highly, but higher. The 20% enrichment that was done ostensibly for the Tehran Research Reactor. Now, there are people looking at that stockpile of 20% and saying, we've got to get it out of there. We can't let them have it. They can't be allowed to enrich it higher than that, possibly to weapons grade. What would you do with this stockpile of 20%? Should it exit the country? Should it be put under IAEA control? What's the answer?
One possibility is for Iran to send it to Russia for further processing, and that's been in discussion for years, and Iran may be amenable to that, and that could be part of a final nuclear deal.
That was RAND Corporation senior analyst Ali Reza Nadir examining what is expected to be in the Iran nuclear agreement.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, and we look forward to your special report.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, using trolling as a propaganda tool, and developments in both camps running for the White House. A secretive Russian program designed to flood the internet with pro-Kremlin and anti-U.S. comments and posts has been brought into the public eye as a result of a lawsuit brought by a former employee. The agency is what's commonly referred to as a troll factory, and until now, its very existence has routinely been denied by the Kremlin. International Edition's Doug Bernard follows cyber issues and joins me now. Hi, Doug.
Great to see you, Susan.
Oh, it's always nice to have you come by the studio. But explain to us, what is a troll factory?
Well, in internet lingo, trolling is the act of leaving blog posts or especially comments on news stories and other sites that are intentionally inflammatory and that are designed specifically to rile people up, get them angry, and turn what might have been a sensible discussion into, you know, it just devolves into into name-calling and whatnot. It's designed to muddy the waters. And so what appears here is that what has come to light is an agency. It's called the Agency for Internet Studies, curious title, that employs hundreds of people whose job is specifically to go out and troll on these websites.
And what did the lawsuit allege, and what came to light because of it?
So it was brought by Ludmila Savchuk. She's in her 30s. She worked at this AIS agency in St. Petersburg for several months. She alleged that she wasn't getting paid enough and that she was working longer than she really should have by labor laws. But really what came to light is how this place works.
This came out in the courtroom.
Now, the Kremlin has routinely denied that any such thing happens. But here we see an example. Ludmila spells out in her lawsuit where employees were created false IDs, went and were expected to leave, you know, 100, 150 comments on various websites every day, basically to accuse the U.S. of being warmongers or support Putin or
propaganda.
Absolutely. Designed to either create the impression of more Putin support than there is, or to sort of muddy the waters with inflammatory accusations and conspiracy theories.
Do we know specifically who is in charge of it or funding it? Do we know for sure?
No, we really don't. Now, technically, AIS is run by Mikhail Bystrov. He's a retired police colonel. However, we've learned that AIS is actually financed through a holding company run by Yevgeny Pigzorin. Now, people may not know who that is. Technically,
no.
He's Vladimir Putin's personal chef.
Wow.
But he also, as the head of several holding companies, which millions of rubles pass through. And in fact, he was recently tied to another media scandal, which was designed, apparently, a conspiracy to plant false information in different Russian newspapers.
Do you think maybe that other countries are doing this as well?
No doubt. But I think what's interesting here is there's a clear link between the government and these kinds of activities. I think many more times, especially in China, people are paid by the government to censor and to take things down from the internet. And I think in some countries, various, you know, de facto, you know, patriotic groups might go out there and campaign for their country. But I don't think, you know, you really see governments actively supporting, you know, these kind of online propaganda efforts.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug. That's a very interesting story, and folks can read it on our website, right?
At yes, they can.
VOAnews.com.
And they're free to leave their comments there as well.
Great. Thanks a lot, Doug.
You bet.
You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Democratic U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has made the first major policy speech of her campaign. National correspondent Jim Malone listened in and joins us here in the studio with details. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, Jim. And the former Secretary of State's remarks focused on the economy today. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, in a nutshell, she wants to talk about boosting economic growth for all Americans, particularly with an eye toward helping middle-class Americans. This has been one of the real themes in recent years in the United States, the declining power of the middle class, declining wages. People want to find ways to improve their lot in our society and in the economy, and Clinton's trying to find ways to do that by boosting the middle class. We should point out, though, that this comes in the wake of an increased challenge from one of her rivals, Bernie Sanders, who's a self-described socialist, who actually has talked about redistributing wealth in the United States. So it looks like Bernie Sanders may be pushing Hillary Clinton a little bit more to the left, though Clinton remains in a strong position in the Democratic primaries.
Well, where does Clinton stand in the polls? Is she still way out in front like she
was? She's out in front, but, you know, Bernie Sanders has been catching up a little bit, particularly in some of these early contest states we like to talk about, Iowa and New Hampshire. She's ahead. But Sanders is narrowing the gap. He's one of four Democratic challengers and by far getting the most notice at the moment. This will go on for a while. Most of the analysts I talk to think Clinton is still a strong favorite.
Well, meanwhile, the Republican field of candidates running for the White House has increased to 15. It's hard to keep track of them all. I mean, 15 of them. The latest one to throw in his hat in the ring is Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. What do we know about this guy?
Well, you know, he's had an interesting career so far. He won two elections as governor in Wisconsin, actually three if you count a recall effort that was mounted by union supporters when he decided to take on the unions in Wisconsin to try to trim their collective bargaining rights. So that actually helped Walker around the country with conservatives. He's considered a strong challenger here. Generally, the top tier of the 15 includes people like Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, Senator Marco Rubio, Florida, and Walker. Walker also is leading in the early polls in Iowa, which is a neighboring state. He spent some time there growing up. So he's seen as one of the favorites, but also probably with a lot to prove, especially on foreign policy, I would say.
Well, thanks, Jim, for stopping by.
You bet.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Brazil have a long history of strong bilateral relations. The two countries hold similar views and goals on many issues. So, for example, both countries are committed to expanding inclusive economic growth and prosperity, promoting international peace and security and respect for human rights, and helping people in need, not just in the United States and Brazil, but globally. This is particularly true of countries that face chronic hunger, such as Mozambique. Mozambique needs help. Two decades ago, the country emerged from 16 years of civil war that left it in shambles, and the 20 years of stability and peace since then have seen significant strides forward, including impressive economic growth. Nonetheless, Mozambique is prone to natural disasters such as droughts and floods, which damage the agricultural sector and the country's overall economy. That is one reason why much of the rural population is impoverished, and as much as 64% of Mozambicans are food insecure. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the University of Florida and Michigan State University, and the Brazilian Cooperation Agency, or ABC, and other Brazilian government agencies have partnered with the government of Mozambique to work on reducing poverty, hunger, and malnutrition as part of Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. The idea is to help strengthen the country's capacity to produce more high-quality and nutritious foods, like vegetables, oilseeds, and grain legumes. The partnership works with family and subsistence farmers to help them increase their yields and then enable them to bring their product to the market. The program strengthened the capacity of Mozambique's Agricultural Research Institute in research administration, seed production, and land use planning. It also worked to improve communication and extension information dissemination, including training and support to extension technicians. Experts from Brazil and the U.S. partners cooperated closely with Mozambican counterparts in making these gains. Farmers were also trained in new crop management practices, such as more environmentally sensitive irrigation technologies. They also learned how to plant better and more disease-resistant crop varieties and improve post-harvest handling in ways that reduced losses and increased incomes. On June 30th, during a meeting with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, President Barack Obama announced an additional $2 million for expanding the USAID and ABC partnership to help Mozambique attain food security for all. No one should have to go to bed hungry. That is the goal to which all of us should aspire. The United States and Brazil are working to reach it, one country at a time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.